From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, bees. Not wasps, which most of us hate, but bees, which most of us love. We humans have a long relationship with bees, and the biologist Tor Hansen has written a book about them. He explores their natural history, like where they came from. They used to be wasps. They used to be carnivores. And they're not all honeybees. There are more species of bees than mammals. You want to hear more? Join us after this.
Keeping KUER on the air isn't easy, especially when you have to go up a mountain. Here's our engineer, Lewis Downey.
The road was icy, and when you ramp up in the snow, your tires aren't touching the ground anymore. So you were sitting here feeling really dumb. This truck happened to have a winch on it, and I found a scrawny little scrub, and I hooked the winch line onto that, and that held while we could pull ourselves back onto the road.
Let Lewis handle the snow. Help KUER get some traction before the fun drive. Go to KUER.org and click donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Don't you love bees? I'm not talking wasps or hornets, which seem to have been stinging a lot of people this year. I'm talking bees, pollinators. The biologist Tor Hansen says we humans have loved bees for thousands of years now. In fact, there's this idea, it's just a theory, but an idea that honey actually helped fuel early human brains. It helped make those brains bigger. So in that sense, maybe we owe our dominance over the planet, at least in part, to the humble bee. So we love them. But what do we know about them? Because Hansen says not that much, or certainly not enough. So he's written a book about bees to help us reconnect with them, as he puts it. He explores their story, where they came from, how they're built, you know, how they have cool wings and antenna and great eyes and stingers. His book is called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. Hansen is a conservation biologist and a Guggenheim fellow. He joined us from a studio on San Juan Island in Washington, and he told us his book is about bees, not just honeybees, all bees, because there are a lot of them.
When we think of bees, our minds immediately turn to the one species that we know best, the honeybee, the domestic honeybee, which we have been close to for thousands of years and have taken all around the world and used so closely with our agricultural practices and harvested honey from them and wax and all these other marvelous uses. They're great creatures, but they really are just one species. And in the world, we have 20,000 other species of bees that are also fascinating and essential to natural systems and in many cases in agricultural settings as well. You know, there are more bees species in the world than all of the mammals and birds combined, and then some. It's an incredibly diverse group of insects. And so this book is an attempt to not ignore honeybees, but to look farther, to share that spotlight of attention with all of these other fascinating creatures, the leafcutter bees and the minor bees and the orchid bees and the alkali bees and sweat bees and carpenter bees, bumblebees, so many that we tend to overlook, but that are marvelous creatures doing essential work for us in nature.
You tell the story in the book that you were listening to some historian on the radio who was talking about how it was that the early English colonists to the Americas, they brought with them some honeybees. And this historian said that if there hadn't been these honeybees, they wouldn't have had anything to pollinate their crops. And you said it nearly made you drive off the road. for you, what you saw is this kind of general ignorance about bees.
Yes. I mean, you could say we're a little bit bee blind. And I almost did go off the road when I heard that, in that we have fully 4,000 species of native bees buzzing happily around North America. And so even if the colonists arriving at Plymouth and Jamestown had forgotten their honeybees at home, they would have found plenty of native bees here ready to do the job of pollination. But I think we have become somewhat bee blind in our focus on the domestic honeybee. And so, again, by broadening our view, we can see all of the great stories, the great evolutionary stories and biological stories that are associated with these other bees in our backyards.
I want to ask you about the experience you had in Costa Rica, which you describe in the book as a kind of a turning point. I'm gathering this was when you really started to think deeply about bees. It sparked this kind of fascination in you. Talk a little bit about that moment.
Sure. Well, my interest in bees really dates back to that research that I was doing in Central America, where I was studying the pollen dispersal and genetics of these large rainforest trees, seed dispersal as well. And what I did was go out into a landscape and genetically fingerprint all of the adult trees of a particular species. And because I had that genetic data and I knew all the individual adults, I could track the movement of pollen, and I could track the movement of seeds, and I could begin to understand how those trees functioned as a population and what happened when the forest was split into fragments and separated by pastures and fields and roads and things. Mm. And I looked at that data, and I could tell that something was moving pollen around out of sight, way up in the canopy of that rainforest. Not just between neighboring trees, but between trees that were a mile and a half apart. And because the tree was a member of the pea family and had these big purple pea flowers, just like the garden peas or sweet peas in your backyard at home, I knew that that something had to be bees. So I co-opted an entomologist friend of mine into joining me for a couple of weeks, and we hired a local field assistant who was handy with a crossbow. And we went out into the forest, firing the crossbow up into the canopy to haul up lines and then haul up traps to try to catch the bees that were doing this pollination work so we could learn what they were. And in all of that effort, we caught a grand total of zero bees. It was a total washout from a scientific standpoint, and I never did learn what species or how many species of bees were responsible for pollinating that tree. It's still a mystery. But the experience sparked this fascination within me for bees and what they were capable of, and that fascination just wouldn't rest. So I've been looking for ways to chase after bees in my work and also in daily life, really, ever since.
But what was the fascination? I mean, beyond the kind of the scientific part of it, what do you find so fascinating about these bees, in particular, the insight that you got from that moment in Costa Rica?
Sure, yeah. So to think of this whole world going on out of sight up in the canopy with the flowers up there and the bees were adapted to that lifestyle, moving around, flying, pollinating, all of this stuff happening out of sight. It really opened my eyes to the relationship between bees and flowers. And in some ways, you know, it's a bit ironic to be astounded by something that I never really saw. But it made me start to look closely everywhere that I went in nature or in my backyard and opened my eyes to this world of fascinating interaction between the bees and the flowers in so many landscapes.
There's something you mentioned really early in the book I wanted to ask you about, that there's this – we have this innate evolutionary response to bugs and this kind of visceral reaction to their exoskeletons, that, you know, that that crunch we hear if we step on them. There's something that in a biological way just really creeps us out.
You're absolutely right. You know, they've done studies of this and learned that the mere sight of insects and spiders can trigger a real measurable reaction in the human brain. It lights up all of these neurons associated with fear and in many cases also associated with disgust. So there is something evolutionary in our response to insects and arthropods in general, those creatures that, unlike us, where we have our structural parts hidden within us in the form of bones, the structural parts of arthropods, the insects and spiders and other crustaceans and things, they have a hard exoskeleton, and they have these softer, goopy bodies on the inside, and that is so fundamentally different, it seems to trigger a reaction within us, which makes our relationship to bees quite unique in this is perhaps the only insect species that we have a fondness for.
Yeah.
And you can see that. You can see that in our history, where bees have been revered in many places and pictured in mythology as human souls, you know, in the form of bees buzzing, and as messengers from the gods, and in some cases even as gods or goddesses themselves, real worship of the bees, in part for all that they have provided in terms of sweetness, honey being the sweetest food in nature and in the human diet for thousands and thousands of years until the advent of refined sugars, but also in the form of light that we got from clean, burning, wonderful smelling beeswax candles, which was the best light that we had for years and years, in that the alternative in most places was burning a tallow candle or an oil lamp that left sort of a smoky, stinky smell in the room. You know, here you had this wonderful, clean burning, sweet smelling light from beeswax. So it was always very valuable in that sense. So sweetness and light and all these other medicinal uses of honey and wax in metal making and pharmaceuticals, so many things made bees important to us and developed this long and very ancient relationship. And somehow we've been able then to overcome this sort of instinctive mistrust of these insects, in spite of their, you know, faceted eyes and waving antennae and exoskeletons. We've developed a real closeness and a fondness for them.
You mentioned in the book what we know and what we don't know about the early history of bees. We don't know a lot, it turns out, but it makes for a really fascinating story. Give us a sense, Tor, and we'll dig into this as we go, but what's a bee? In the sense that, what's the difference between a bee and a wasp, for example, or a bee and a hornet? Because they're different, obviously.
They are different, and this is a really great question. We don't have excellent fossil evidence from the key moment when bees were evolving. They're very scarce in the fossil record. But through several other means, we've been able to pinpoint roughly when it happened. And it occurred approximately 120 million years ago in the middle of the Cretaceous period, which was a time famously dominated by the dinosaurs. But if you can look past those lumbering beasts for a minute, there was a lot of other interesting stuff going on in that Cretaceous landscape. It was just the moment when the flowering plants were beginning to really spread and diversify. And bees evolved at that time by making a dietary shift. They evolved from the wasps. So it's important to remember that wasps came first and had been around for millions of years. But where wasps are inherently hunters and scavengers, out looking around the landscape for insects to hunt or spiders to kill or bits of flesh to take home to feed their babies at the nest, bees gave up that lifestyle and shifted to this new resource, the flowers that were beginning to spread at that time. And they learned to supply themselves and their offspring at the nest solely from the nectar and the pollen provided by flowers. They became essentially vegetarian wasps. And that shift set them on their own evolutionary pathway.
You write about the work of Michael Engel in the book. He's this entomologist and paleontologist, and he's been sort of breaking down what we know and, what, as we said, what we don't know about the history of bees. And his hypothesis, I thought, was interesting. Somehow, and we're not quite sure how long this took, but he talks about Engel, talks about how These wasps were capturing prey on flowers, and they had pollen on them. And somehow the wasps started to eat it, and then one thing leads to another, and then they make this shift. Do you want to sort of explain this?
Sure. And it's very hypothetical in that we don't have the fossil record. We would need the perfect situation of a fossil proto-bee nest with everything happening at once to get to the bottom of it. But this is a very likely scenario that Michael thinks may explain how bees evolved. And that is, if you had these wasps in that landscape that were hunters, well, one of the places they would hunt would be on these flowers and flowering plants as they were evolving, would be a good place to find other insects that might be on those flowers, feeding on nectar or beginning to feed on the pollen or what have you. It would be a good hunting ground. And so the wasps would be visiting these flowers, and they would return then to their nests with bits of pollen stuck inadvertently to their bodies. And so they might still be feeding a dead insect or a paralyzed spider to their young, but the young might also then have access to pollen in the nest and begin to feed on that as well. Mm-hmm. And so when that shift happened to a solely pollen-based diet, that is the essential moment. But you can imagine if this is going on where hunting is occurring on flowers or where these wasps are beginning to learn that, hey, we can drink this nectar ourselves and get an energy boost while we're out foraging, which wasps continue to do. Today they will drink nectar to feed themselves even if they're hunting for their babies. So if you have that activity going on flowers, wasps returning to their nests with pollen on their bodies, their offspring, their larvae, learning eventually that pollen is also good food for them, and then at some point shifting over completely to pollen as a food source, that is the key moment that led to bees.
Mm. Do we know, obviously the fossil record is terrible, but were they striped in those early days? I mean, how big were they? How did their bodies evolve? Do we have any sense of that?
Well, it's hard to know because of the lack of fossils, but it's likely that they were small in that many wasp species are small. And at that time, many of the early flowers that were developing were tiny. And so for these creatures to be frequenting them, it's very likely they were small at that time. But among the things that began to change in terms of their bodies, certain changes to the tongue, better adapted for drinking nectar from flowers and lengthening to be able to sip from deep flower tubes as the flowers began to get larger and evolve. But then also on their bodies, the evolution of hair. In that simple wasp hair is a single strand, and it's not very common. It's there perhaps for purposes of thermoregulation, if you will, maintaining body temperature in certain places over the muscles, for example. But it's not branched the way bee hairs are. Bee hairs, or at least many of them, become feather-like in that if you look through magnification, you see that the hairs themselves are branched, vastly increasing their surface area, an adaptation then for the transport of pollen grains from flowers back to the nest. So that is one of the key innovations, really, in terms of the bee body that you can see, even on bees that it may have lost their pollen-gathering habit, in that many bees now are parasitic on other bees. They will steal, in a sense, or exploit the pollen and nectar gathered by other bees and lay their eggs like cuckoo birds, if you will, in the nests of other bees. So they may not gather pollen much themselves, and they may have lost much of their hair, but they'll still have, somewhere on their body, some of these ancestral branched feathery hairs that are the telltale, that give them away as modern parasitic bees.
Interesting how Charles Darwin was kind of mystified by this branched hair, called it the abominable mystery. And he seems like he was really taken by and tried to figure out just how it is bees could co-evolve with these other plants and how the branched hair worked. He seemed fascinated by it.
Darwin was fascinated by bees, and what he later wrote, you know, a book about bees and pollination, particularly of the orchids. But his abominable mystery was really something that he saw in the fossil record and that others had commented upon as well. And that was the sudden rise of the flowering plants. In that if you look through the fossil record, you have no flowering plants. It's all, you know, early seed plants and conifers and various things. And then all of a sudden, in the middle to late Cretaceous, flowering plants are everywhere, and they're diverse. And this was a real challenge to Darwin's concept of evolution as a slow and incremental process. How on earth did these flowering plants evolve so rapidly? And his theory was that, in fact, they didn't evolve rapidly. They must have evolved slowly someplace else and then dispersed rapidly to a place where they became fossilized. But he also corresponded with a lesser-known naturalist of the time, a Frenchman named Gaston de Saporta, who wrote to Darwin with his theory, which was that the flowering plants did evolve rapidly because of their association with flower-visiting insects, particularly the bees, and that it was this co-evolutionary dance between flowering plants and bees that led to rapid evolution and great diversity on both sides of the equation. In that if you are a plant relying upon an insect for pollination, for reproduction, if you will, it's an extremely important part of your life cycle. So there is a great evolutionary pressure there. And changes that affect that one way or another will be immediately evident in the next generation. And so if you want to attract bees, then it creates a real impetus for the evolution of colors that attract bees, shapes that attract bees, scent that attracts bees, all of these variables then that can be shifted through evolution in various ways to create this mass diversity that we see when we, you know, walk through a wildflower meadow or visit a flower shop for that matter. And many of those shapes and scents and colors that we associate with flowers wouldn't be there if it weren't for the need to advertise for the services of bees.
Tor Hansen, his new book is called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER's Fall Fun Drive is happening soon. It starts on September 29th. We're able to keep our fun drive short because listeners like you contribute before the drive. Sure, you probably like being the early bird, but you also know how important public radio is right now. Help us kick off the fun drive by supporting us today. Go to KUER.org and click donate. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about bees. The biologist Tor Hansen has written a book that explores the natural history of these creatures, like where they came from. They used to be wasps, by the way, and they're not all honeybees. There are more species of bees than mammals. His book is called Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. You describe the structure, kind of the architecture of bees as having this, I think you put it, this elegant logic reveals, you say, how bees live and how they work and how they perceive their world. And I wanted to talk about a few of the elements of the structure of a bee. And I wanted to start with the antenna, their feelers. They sound incredibly complex and intricate. I was fascinated by the fact that they sense actually sense the magnetic field of the earth.
Yeah, it truly is remarkable, you know, to think of bee antennae and all of the things that they sense. In that, so far, we been able to isolate at least 7 sensory organs associated with the antennae, which to me means that, you know, when we were kids and we called them feelers on insects, you know, that actually was a pretty good name. Education in biology sort of drove it out of me. But I've kind of returned to it now, thinking, you know, this is really a marvelous way to describe antennae, because they are feeling, they are sensing the world in so many ways. And as you mentioned, you know, the bees have the ability to sense magnetic fields, but they can also smell through their antennae, and they're very sensitive to touch and to air pressure and to wind speed and direction. All of these different senses that help the bee navigate and interact with its world. If you can imagine, trying to feel what it would be like to have your nose at the end of this long stalk that, also contained your taste buds and, allowed you to sense air pressure and wind. It's a phenomenal thing to think about. All of the sensations that are coming in through those long antennae. And it's no wonder then that bees take such good care of them. And you can see them grooming those antennae, cleaning them of dirt and pollen, keeping them in pristine shape so that they can use them then to navigate their world.
Let's talk about their eyes. What does a bee see? They have 5 eyes, but you say that's a little misleading.
Well, they do. It's a little misleading in that 3 of them are what are called ocelli, which are these they look like little half-glass marbles on the top of the head. And they are very light-sensitive and particularly sensitive to polarized light. So they provide a good signal that is helpful in bee navigation. And they're found on other insects and arthropods as well. So those 3 of the 5 are fairly primitive and don't create a visual image. But then bees have these massive faceted eyes that take up a good part of the head, 2 of them. And what's interesting about those eyes is that unlike the eyes that we have, or mammals, and the eyes that we're most used to, which are soft organs and, adapt and shift their shape to focus the light on our retinas, the facets of bee eyes and other insects are fixed. They are fixed at a particular focal depth, right? They can't change the shape of those little hard facets. They are fixed. They're all individually wired into the bee brain so that they can see, but it's at a fixed distance. So from a long way away, you know, the world is very blurry to the bees, and it only comes into sharp focus when they get close to things. But what is really incredible about their vision is what happens in terms of motion, in that, you know, with our eyes, we see something move. It's focused onto our retinas and the brain interprets it from there. But with bee vision, you're firing all of these individual sensors when something moves across that line of sight. If you can imagine, dragging your fingers across harp strings and every string makes a sound. Well, that's sort of how it must be for a bee to see something moving, in that as it crosses their field of vision, each one of those facets is individually wired to the brain. And it creates a very great sensitivity to motion in their world, which is very useful for not only navigating and moving around, but avoiding predators and responding to other insects in their environment or other creatures of any kind. They're very, very sensitive to motion, which is part of the reason, if you've ever tried catching bees in a net or what have you, a lot of the time they'll evade you. And that is because they can see that net coming in a way we can hardly imagine.
I love your description of the bees' wings as being like stained glass windows waiting for color. And when you look at them, it seems like they're fixed, but they're not. Talk a little bit about their wings and what a high-speed video camera reveals about how they actually move and flex.
Well, it's a marvelous story in part because the poor old bees, particularly the bumblebees, have long been subject to misinformation and this old cultural meme that they were aerodynamically impossible, that these big burly bumblebees couldn't possibly fly because their wings were too small and they didn't provide enough surface area to create enough lift. And this is an old story that was, of course, based upon the calculations you would make when figuring or designing a fixed-wing aircraft. And indeed, bee wings, for a bumblebee particularly, they are small compared to the size of the body. But they are anything but fixed. They move. They move and flex in all sorts of ways, not only up and down, but back and forth. It's almost more like they are rowing themselves through the water. And their great ability to adjust those movements allows them to fly in all sorts of conditions, adjusting for air pressure and wind speed on the spot, on the fly, if you will, and even in the very thin air of alpine areas, which is a real test for flight capabilities. But there was a marvelous study done on some Himalayan bumblebees recently that showed not only are they good flyers at a normal elevation, but if you lower the air pressure to what it would be at the top of Mount Everest or even above Mount Everest, and then video the bees in that setting, you can watch as they adjust the shape and the speed of their wing movements to adapt to that low pressure condition and maintain their flight even at those incredible altitudes. So bees, far from being poor flyers, are in fact quite remarkable in how they fly.
The stinger, of course, is one of the things that a lot of people think of first when they think of bees. You mentioned how bees, in fact, rarely sting. Some bees aren't even capable of stinging. Talk a little bit about how a stinger evolved. I had no idea that originally you say it was an extension of just the female reproductive system.
Yes, the stinger it has evolved from what is called in the textbooks the ovipositor, which is the egg-laying device of the female wasp or bee. It evolved from that female system so that when we talk about stings and being stung by a bee, you can immediately do away with all the males. They are incapable of it because they simply don't have the equipment. So it's only the female bees that sting. And even among the females, many of them have either lost the capability or are extremely reluctant to use it. When we think about the strength of a sting, it's often associated with what that bee has to defend. And so we find the stronger stings, generally speaking, there are exceptions, but the stronger ones are usually associated with the highly social bees, the honeybees or even the bumblebees, those that live in a social colony with a queen and workers and a division of labor. And they number hundreds or thousands, or in the case of some honeybees, tens of thousands of individuals in that nest. And they've built up a huge store of food resources in pollen and honey, and they're tending all sorts of larvae in that nest. So they have a lot to defend. And in that situation, defending the nest, that is where you tend to see bees become more aggressive and where you tend to see the stronger stings. But those social creatures, those social bees, are the exception to the rule. The vast majority of the world's 20,000 bee species are solitary. It is a lone female supplying a tiny nest someplace in a hole in the ground or in a crack or a hole in a piece of wood or even an empty snail shell upon occasion. And they don't have so much to defend. They're on their own. And so they're much more likely to flee and abandon that nest, if attacked, than to try and defend it. And so their stingers are weak and rarely used. And in some groups, some fairly large groups, the ability to sting has been lost altogether.
You mention write about Brian Griffin, a former insurance salesman who's fascinated by bees. And one of the things that he explores are these solitary bees and the fact that they're, even though these bees, as you say, the vast majority are solitary, why it is they seem to want to hang out together. This kind of the fact that they want to be social. Talk a little bit about that. I thought this was really interesting.
It is quite interesting, and Brian's story is fascinating. One of the things I love about it is that, as you mentioned, he had a career as an insurance salesman and only discovered bees in retirement when he was, digging a fence post hole in his backyard, and he saw all these tiny little black insects that were gathering clay and soil from that hole, and he followed them to where they were nesting, and he realized these were solitary bees. These were orchard mason bees, and he began this wonderful exploration and eventually even began a business by building homes for these bees, allowing them to build their nests, and then taking these things to garden shows and selling them so that people would have these wonderful pollinators come out in their orchards the following spring. So it's a great story of discovery. But he did make this interesting observation that even though they're solitary, it's a single female that is supplying the nest that she has created in these little holes, and he drilled holes in wood so they could make this happen and observe it. The females go in and they supply a single cell with some pollen and a bit of nectar mixed together, a wonderful situation. They call it bee bread, and you can imagine then this little larvae munching away on that. So they lay a single egg, close it off, do it again and again until they fill that hole with a series of these little cells, all on their own. Yet they want to be next to other bees doing the same thing. And so here he would put out his bee homes, full of holes in various places in his orchard. And he found that again and again, the bees usually would concentrate in one area to fill up these holes. And he was curious about that. Why did they do that? If they're not really social, why are they together? And part of it in nature is thought that, it is simply often a scarcity of appropriate habitat, in that there are limited places where you find just the right soil that is bare, that has the right moisture to dig into for bees of certain species. Or you find a limited area that has holes that are the right width and that allow a bee to build a nest of particular species. So there's a limit in terms of habitat that may draw bees together. But there also could be, more of a defense in numbers aspect to this from an evolutionary standpoint, in that when you have bees that are building their nests and filling them with food and then sealing them off and leaving them, these are resources that other creatures are going to want to exploit. Whether it is a woodpecker that knows it can peck in there and get not only a larva, but whatever bee bread is remaining, or whether it may be a parasitic wasp that has learned that, in fact, it can lay its egg hidden in these bee nests and its larva can subsist on that bee bread, or can subsist on the larva itself that's growing in there. This is common as well. You have these parasites that will lay their eggs on the larvae of bees, and the larvae are consumed by this wasp larvae. So when you have one of these nests out in nature, it's a very active place, and there could be then a benefit to otherwise solitary bees from being in a larger aggregation, in that if these parasites come along or other predators, there's a bit of the safety in numbers aspect to it.
So is it true that every third bite of food in the human diet relies on a bee? And maybe explain it in the proposition you test in the book of what a bee might have to do with a McDonald's Big Mac.
Oh, yes. Well, the common phrase and statistic one hears is that every third bite of food is dependent in one way or another – upon bees. And that is quite a startling number. There are many ways to parse the numbers. We can look at the amount of food grown in the world and see that, yes, maybe 35% of crop production relies upon bees or benefits from bees in terms of pollination. Or we can look at the varieties of food and find that, in fact, you know, 85% of our top 110 food crops rely upon bees or benefit from bees for pollination. So the diversity of food then is perhaps even more dependent upon bees. But what I decided to do as a small experiment in the book was look for bees in someplace unexpected. If we go to a farmer's market or to the produce aisle of the grocery store, the connection to bees is rather intuitive. You look around and you see all these wonderful fruits and vegetables and nuts, and it's not too hard to imagine that if we didn't have bees, many of those things would never be pollinated. So I decided to look in an unexpected place and went to McDonald's and dissected a Big Mac hamburger, because I thought, well, this is a meal where you are not sitting down feeling like you're interacting with bees at all. And so what would be left if we dissected a Big Mac and took out all of the ingredients that rely one way or another upon bees? Because this is happens to be a meal where many of us at least know the recipe by heart. It's the two all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun, this famous advertising jingle that's still stuck in our heads decades later. So I did that. I took this thing apart with my tweezers and my reference books at a McDonald's, ignoring the curious stares of the people at the next table. And I made a pile on one side of what would be left. And then I made a pile the other side of things that would have to go without bees. And it was surprising in that, sure, I could still have the two all-beef patties, in that cows, of course, can be raised upon grass alone, which is a wind-pollinated plant. Fine. And the buns as well could be there, although without the sesame seeds. I had to pick 243 sesame seeds off the top bun. But the bun, again, made from flour that is a grass, you know, from grass-pollinated grains. I mean, from, excuse me, wind-pollinated grains. But almost everything else on that burger had to be removed. You know, things like the pickles that are bee-pollinated cucumbers, things like the lettuce, which, sure, we're only using the leaves, but the seeds of iceberg lettuce were developed by W. Atlas Burpee at his farm, that famous seed breeder. That variety was in an open bee-pollinated trial at his farm. And even on to things like the special sauce, which again includes some pickle, but also the vegetable oils that make it creamy. Come from bee-pollinated canola, which is a mustard, or from soybean oil, which, while it can self-pollinate, produces 10 to 40% more in a field that is visited by bees.
I want to ask about the threats and the way you write about the future that you see for bees. This brings us to Robin Thorpe's work, among others. 40% of species are in decline, you mentioned, or at least threatened with extinction right now. And Robin Thorpe believes there's a pathogen or something that's making bees susceptible to parasites and mites and bacteria. What do we know about what's happening to bees?
Sure. So in the 21st century, you really can't talk about bees without confronting the challenges that they face. And this sort of came on the scene in 2006 when something called colony collapse disorder began decimating commercial honeybee hives. People were losing 30, 40, 80, even 90% of their hives in a mass die-off. And if there's good news from all of that, it really lies in the research that it inspired, the attention that was drawn to bees, not just to honeybees, but to wild bees, native bees as well. And what we've learned over the course of all this research, if we've learned anything, it's that it's more than one thing. It's not just one smoking gun that is causing declines in bees. They are suffering from what some experts have begun calling multiple stress disorder. And the key ones are often summarized now as the four P's. They are parasites and pesticides and pathogens and something called poor nutrition.
You visited an almond orchard in California as a way of trying to kind of understand bee habitat conservation and restoration. And I wanted to ask you about what is being done, because you write about like these wildflower mixes and growing blossoming shrubs, and also weed control is another way of dealing with habitat conservation. What does it mean to conserve the habitat of a bee?
Well, the great news is that in spite of the challenges of bringing bees back, of bee conservation, and the challenges of these problems they face from the pesticides and the pathogens and all of these other things, is that we know enough to take action and to take action in specific ways. And we know that bees respond, and sometimes very quickly, to the actions that we take. It's one of the few times in conservation biology where you can experience instant gratification, in that if you plant bee habitat, they find it and occupy it very quickly in most cases. They're constantly out in the landscape looking for floral resources. And so when those resources appear, they use their wonderful navigation skills to find them. And you raised the example of the almond orchard that I visited in California's Central Valley, which is a marvelous example in that those almond trees, every almond that you eat is the product of bee pollination. They must be pollinated by bees. But because of the vast acreage in almonds and other monocultures in that Central Valley in California, which is a wonderful agricultural area, but most of the bee habitat is now gone. And so for those almonds to be pollinated, the growers must rent hives, and people bring domestic beehives from all over North America for this frenzy of pollination during the brief spring bloom of those almonds. 2 million hives or more are required to pollinate all those almonds. And so in this situation, then, you have a lack of bees and orchardists who are very eager to address that problem however they can, and there's real interest now in bringing more bee habitat back to that landscape. So people have begun planting, hedgerows of flowering shrubs and plants that provide bee habitat, and have learned that doing so can triple the abundance and diversity of bees in an orchard in a single season. It happens so quickly. The bees that are there are looking for habitat. And when you provide that habitat, it's, to borrow one cultural meme and apply it to a different situation, it's like the field of dreams. If you build it, they will come.
Yeah. Which leads me to sort of my final question. It's this story you tell about being there in California at this almond orchard and seeing a bee, just a solitary bee. You weren't sure what you would see that late in the season, but there was a bee in a patch of gumweed, which was still in bloom. And there was this little bee there, and you saw him, and you were kind of taken by it. And you saw him as a, I think as you put it in the book, as kind of a symbol of resilience. Tell that story, if you would, and give me a sense of how you're thinking about the future of bees now.
Sure. So that was, again, on this trip to the Central Valley. And we went to look at a particular hedgerow, a long one, over a mile long, on the edge of a road through this heavily developed agricultural landscape. And it was so striking because one side of the road had no hedgerow and was just a barren, desolate, dusty moonscape, if you will, with a few dried out husks of weeds there. And then on the other side of the road, directly across, here was this hedgerow of native plants, still green, still quite beautiful, even though it was past the peak of the flowering period. And as I walked through it, I saw dragonflies and I heard birds singing, all of these creatures that were using that habitat that had been recreated there, and butterflies and other things. And then suddenly on this little yellow gumweed, which is a beautiful little, yellow flower, like a daisy, if you will, in that same family. Here was this marvelous sweat bee, a female, gathering pollen, and I knew that somewhere nearby, probably in the ground, she had a nest that she was provisioning. And it was such a wonderful symbol of hope that you could, even in this landscape, at the end of the season, find a native bee on a native wildflower. And it gave me a real sense of encouragement for the future of bees, even though they face real and daunting challenges in the modern world. They respond, and they respond quickly to the help that we can give them. And many of the things that challenge them are things we have some control over. We can provide more flowers in the landscape. And by building up their floral resources, their dietary choices, if you will, we make them stronger to help resist the other challenges they face. We can reduce pesticide use in many of our agricultural settings, or change how we use pesticides and the timing and the types so that we have less impact on non-target species like bees. We have control over that. And again, the bees respond. And the fewer of these stressors and threats that are impacting them, whether it's poor nutrition or pesticides, the stronger they will be to fight off some of those stressors we have less control over, like the parasites or pathogens that might be out there in their environment that they have to face. So we have the ability to help them. They respond to that help. And seeing that little sweat bee on the gumweed was to me a wonderful symbol for what we can do if we take action.
Tor Hansen, he's a conservation biologist, author of the book Buzz, The Nature and Necessity of Bees. He joined us from a studio on San Juan Island in Washington. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Tim Slover directs the show, with thanks to Holly Vasek. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.